Hello and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I'm Vincent McCorry, filling in for Sheikh Sali. Today, we'll look at the impact of the second wave of the coronavirus pandemic in Africa. An average of 28 of the continent's 54 countries have reported a higher number of new COVID-19 cases each week since October, with an average of 22,000 new cases per day in December. Now, to talk about the challenges this surge poses for the continent, I'm joined by Dr. Ahmed Oguelo Umah, Deputy Director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and Talbert Nyeswa, Senior Research Associate at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, member of the panel of experts for the Global Health Security Index, and former Deputy Minister of Health, Emergencies and Epidemic Control of Liberia. Gentlemen, I'm happy to have you, and I feel safe actually now. I'm surrounded by two health experts, so I have nothing to worry about. Thank you, and once again, welcome to Straight Talk Africa. Let me start with you, Dr. Umah. Can you please get us up to speed on what the COVID situation across Africa is at this moment, in as few words as you can?
Now, thank you for having me. As we speak, we have reached cumulatively just over 2.8 million Africans have been infected with this virus since the pandemic started. We've lost about 69,000 people on the continent. Over the last 1 month, we are seeing a distinct increase in numbers. So Africa is certainly in its second wave of the pandemic. But the numbers are still not as bad as elsewhere in the world, but for sure we are experiencing our second wave, and we are watching very closely how the numbers will behave that are coming to a close this weekend.
Now, Mr. Nyeswa, many have asked, why does Africa seem to be doing so well? You know, in any of this kind of situations, people would have expected Africa to be doing worse than the rest of the world. What is the explanation?
I think, thank you, Vincent, for having me, and thank you for having me on. I think some of the factors, the major driving force for me is the African experience of dealing with infectious diseases. For example, like Ebola, measles, polio, Lassa fever, monkeypox, and some of these infectious diseases. I was one person who sounded the alarm when I spoke to the World Economic Forum that Africa was on a time bomb during the first and second quarter of 2020, when the virus SARS-2 COVID-19 virus hit Africa. But then looking back 10 months after and see the progress that Africa have made can be attributed to the factor that I told you about, experience with infectious diseases, leadership and governance and the structures that have been put in place after the Ebola, led by my colleague Ahmed is telling you from, he's now speaking from the Africa CDC. When I dealt with Ebola as the incident manager in West Africa, we didn't have anything called Africa CDC. Today, the continent has a body to deal with infectious diseases, and the containment, I think, is going well in Africa. Age is another factor. You know, age is a predisposing factor for COVID-19. People above 65 are both exposed and with preconditions and other things. And so looking at the young age of Africa is also helping us, basically.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dr. Umah, one of the issues that has been very difficult for most people, for most countries, is enforcing, you know, the social distancing measures, use of covering of the face and, you know, even other measures that need to be taken. And this has been a problem even in Western, rich Western countries. Now, how is Africa doing on that, especially when we consider areas where people live in crammed, overcrowded conditions? They're generally poorer and they don't have as much support as you would expect or you would hope for.
Thank you. You know, the equalizer here is that the spread of this virus is from human to human. So wherever there are human beings, it will spread if they don't take care of themselves as they're supposed to. And the human behavior, we have seen it cuts across all strata, all age groups, all socioeconomic populations. It's something that is expected. We are not achieving it yet. And although a personal responsibility is the key to ensuring that these public health measures are effected properly, we can be able to provide an enabling environment by enforcement, by reminders, by ensuring that the environment is appropriate for carrying out those measures by members of the public. In Africa, what we are seeing is that wearing of masks is not consistent. There are parts of Africa where masks are worn more. There are parts of a country, for example, in the cities, where masks would be worn more. There are parts of the country, for example, the rural areas, where mask wearing is less. So it is a very mixed picture. And then if you take into consideration the fact that the African culture is one of socializing and regularly socializing. Indeed, our economy is based on a lot of informal engagements. So people need to meet and talk before they can be able to carry out any sort of business. Despite this, I must give you to Africans that when the pandemic reached the continent, the discipline with which most of the members of the public took the public health measures really helped to keep the numbers low. And so as the numbers increase, they are not increasing from a huge base. They're increasing from a relatively smaller base. And that is how we are managing to keep the numbers to levels that others had predicted otherwise. But for sure, it is a challenge. We must continue to remind members of the public the importance of the individual behavior. We must continue to provide an enabling environment for this to happen. We must continue to enforce where it is required to be enforced so that these public health measures actually continue to be respected and they continue to be implemented by members of the public. But Africa is not that much different from elsewhere in the world in as far as the patchiness of implementation of these public health measures is concerned.
Yes, you see, Dr. Omar has mentioned something very critical because one of the CDC recommendations to help stop the spread of COVID is if you have mild symptoms, do not go to school, do not go to work, or to other public places until you're completely free of all symptoms. Now, for millions of Africans, as the doctor just mentioned, they make a living in the informal sector. Most of their earnings are daily. They have to go out there to sell their wares, to work on as day laborers in order to get the daily wage to feed their families. How practical is this recommendation?
Sometimes it's impractical, but for public health reasons, it's good to follow some of the measures, especially where necessary. But for the tools that's in the toolbox that is very effective, the testing measures, the rapid, quick testing of symptomatic people, especially those who are symptomatic, those who are asymptomatic can be difficult, but the more we test people who we realize having signs and symptoms of the virus, the quickly you can contain it. Because when you know and find a case and who is confirmed, then you can institute the rest of the measures, which is contact tracing, isolation. And then specifically, you can look at communities that are high risk and maybe put in measures of social distancing and telling a segment of the people to either contain themselves or quarantine themselves as compared to locking down on the whole area in Africa, which is not applicable and practical based on the informal sector and food insecurity.
Dr. Umar, as a CDC, you definitely are so focused on how to fight this pandemic, how to coordinate with the rest of the world in order to succeed in stemming this spread. But I know you're not holding brief for any political leaders here, but would it have been much helpful if there was some public funding that would go into helping, especially the most vulnerable Africans who rely on the informal sector, so they can be given some cushioning when they lose all this income because they're not able to work in the informal sector that ends up bringing people too close to each other and making them susceptible to, infections and the spreading of the disease?
That's a double-edged sword, as it were. On one hand, we have government revenues dropping quite significantly as a result of the less economic activities that are going on during lockdown season and during pandemics in general. So it means government income will have gone down. But governments must find a way of cushioning members of the public, particularly those who rely on the small businesses, so that you do not end up with the public health measures not being completely respected. And governments can be able to do that in many ways. And I think many countries on the continent have tried to lower taxes, tax holidays and things like that for their citizens. And this helps. We don't yet have a good example where in Africa governments are actually paying salaries up front, for example, income replacement, because of issues around where the money can be able to come from. But there are economic stimulus ways of getting some of those resources to members. Can we encourage that? But at the same time, as Africa CDC, we must commend our governments on the continent that during this pandemic they have come through, they have supported. We have pledges upwards of $150 million from the governments within Africa only. And this is helping a lot in our preparedness and support activities towards COVID-19 on the continent. So there are different ways that governments can be able to ensure that they are participating and they are contributing to the fight against COVID-19. But at country level, really, it depends on how much resources the government can be able to release to members of the public, so that the economic activities can continue, and tax holidays are a good example that what has been going on the continent, so that public health measures can be able to continue being respected. If we don't respect public health measures, then we will see the numbers really, really climb, and we don't want that situation because our health systems are not yet ready for really huge, huge numbers of critically ill people.
Talbot, yes, so as a person who served in government, I may want to ask you, what do you make of the suspicions among the citizens of many African countries that monies that were supposed to be set aside to fight the COVID-19 have been misappropriated? I actually like to use the word stolen by those in government, their cronies and families, and some have even become millionaires because of this. And because of that, some Africans have concluded that perhaps there is no COVID-19. This is a ploy by governments, by those in power, to find a way to once again enrich themselves using the excuse of, COVID-19 funding.
Thank you. Great question, Vincent. The first thing we need to erase is the conspiracy that there is no COVID-19. Our people on the continent should believe that this disease is contagious, is dangerous, is affecting people. That's number one. Number two is the issue of corruption needs to be thoroughly investigated. in an outbreak response like COVID-19, like what we had in Ebola in West Africa, the issue of accountability and transparency is number one. And so the anti-graft institutions need to investigate thoroughly of if people are found to be corrupt and pocket COVID-19 resources. They need to be brought to book and prosecuted for that, because transparency should be key. Accountability during an outbreak response, you cannot overemphasize how important it is, because diseases and outbreaks tie to the lives of people. You want to save lives. And if people are not having trust in their governments because of corruption, then it needs to be investigated and prosecuted.
Dr. Umar, throughout this pandemic, one country that has stood out, has not been bothered at all with this issue, is Tanzania. Now, has Tanzania been really skipped by the coronavirus? Or is there something we need to know? What has the CDC found out?
We come from the Africa Union, and Tanzania is one of our members. But let me say three things in relation to that. One is data sharing is an extremely important part of our work when it comes to controlling public health emergencies. If you don't share data, then you cannot be able to be prepared across borders. And this is one challenge that we see when countries are not sharing our data. The second thing I would like to say is that there is no place in Africa where there is no COVID. There is COVID, whether you report it or you don't report it, COVID is there, and the effects are visible in the way that it affects the numbers, particularly the excess death that we can be able to calculate for each and every country. The third thing is the issue of leadership. Particularly on the continent, and we have seen exceptional leadership during this COVID pandemic season, where our heads of state as a Bureau of the Africa Union have met over now 8 times to discuss COVID and give us a strategic direction, provide their political support so that we can be able to do our technical work more effectively. And this leadership has been speaking with countries where we are not receiving enough data, enough information. But from the information that we have, we know that COVID does exist in each and every country on the continent. And the only way for us to be able to support our member states on the continent is for those member states to share data with us. Then we can be able to come in and help. Otherwise, helping becomes extremely difficult. But you cannot be able to hide illness. You cannot be able to hide disease. You cannot be able to hide excess deaths. These ones will always be able to come through when the data is actually made available.
You know, Mr. Nyeshua, there has always been a culture of denial at the government level, even when there are issues just like famine or severe shortages of food in some countries. Governments will make it look like it's an exaggeration by the media. So do you see this as a problem across the continent? Because we mentioned Tanzania, but people say many African countries or a number of African countries may not be providing accurate data that can be used to help. Why in the first place would you want to deny the reality on the ground? What does it benefit governments to not acknowledge what exactly is happening when there could be some help coming in if people knew the real truth and have the actual accurate data?
So let me say this much. During my days as Deputy Minister of Health for Surveillance and then Director General of the National Public Health Institute, I paid a visit to one of our provinces in the Southeast and met with the district and county surveillance officers trying to, you know, look at like an assessment to look at what they were doing at the district and county level from the emergency operations centers and looking at their data and all of that. And one of the district surveillance officers, I was asking him, are you sure the data is accurate? He told me, he said, look, chief, let me give you this information. If you hide a disease, the disease will expose you. So if you had an infectious disease like Ebola, like Lassa fever, like COVID-19, and you don't want to report it, it will get to report you. That's the whole thing. Yes, there are issues. There are issues with reporting. There are issues with data. There are issues with health information system on the continent. But I believe when the disease is in there, it's going to report it, because the surrogates for mobility is mortality. Meaning, if people are getting sick and you're not reporting that, the deaths will come up and people will start dying and your government will be in trouble. So it's good to be transparent with data, report the cases, even if it's a problem. It's better to solve it together than to cover it up and others may not know. The reason sometimes that the reporting system, the requirement for the International Health Regulation of 2005, that countries are required to report diseases, and sometimes countries hide that, is because of trade and commercial reasons. They feel that they will get isolated and the rest of the world will isolate them because they are disease-driven countries. Like you see other countries associating the disease with another country because of the origin of the disease. I think we should stop that. What we should do is to deal with the disease at its source, and then we will stop a pandemic that will start from a village. Because in 24 hours, trust me, with travel and everything, a disease that happened in Addis Ababa can quickly come to Washington because Ethiopian Airlines is flying. A disease in Nairobi can be in Accra or in Monrovia because Kenya Airways is flying. So we need to work together holistically using the reporting systems that we all have, integrated disease surveillance system that we have, and report those diseases to the WHO and in our national system, and then respond rapidly. That's the way forward. Thank you.
Yes. Dr. Omar, something I want to ask, and Talbot might chime in on this, is the experiences of the past. We know that Africa has experienced Ebola. We saw the devastation in West Africa, but way before then, there was Uganda and the DRC. Are there best practices that could have been taken or have been taken from these scenarios that can help Africa or are helping Africa today? And if not, should be put in place to help the continent?
In fact, as Talbot was mentioning, one of the things is the experience we have had with previous outbreaks. Indeed, there are outbreaks that are going on on the continent. The media don't pick it up. During 2020, we've responded to 17 different outbreaks on the continent, but everyone remembers COVID. So the experiences we have had with other outbreaks, and particularly Ebola most recently in DRC, have helped us to shape the preparedness and response for COVID-19. And it is very important to note that African countries actually have a public health system. Many other countries out there have hospitals, not a public health system. And the presence of a public health systems all the way down to the community has really, really helped. This is one very key learning, is that involve the community. Let the community know what is happening and how they can be able to prevent this from spreading and what their role can be. This is one very key lesson. Second is act early. And this time we acted early. The first case was reported on February 14th in Egypt. And 1 week later, February 22nd, all health ministers came together here in Addis, and we developed our strategic plan, which we are using now to respond. So responding early. And you will recall that many countries on the continent went into lockdowns very rapidly, and it kept the numbers low. And this has really, really helped. Third is leadership from the very top. We've had coordination meetings of different sectors, ministers of health, ministers of finance, ministers of transport, ministers of foreign affairs, our heads of states, the regional economic blocs, coming together, talking, agreeing on what needs to be done, and then in solidarity, taking action. So this kind of leadership we have learned is extremely important, especially early on in the pandemic. And then finally, the presence of partners and friends, where all of us come together and work around one plan. We have one plan for the continent, and we are encouraging all countries to have one plan within the country, and everyone contributing to that. So it means every resource is synergistic and not wasted. So these are some of the lessons that we have learned from particularly Ebola recently, and we are applying them in the case of COVID-19, building the capacity within the continent. And I am quite confident that any other outbreak that will come, which will be multi-country in nature, we'll be able to tackle it even more efficiently, because COVID is giving us even more lessons for us to learn, be better prepared, and be able to respond quickly and contain whatever outbreak it is. But one very big gap is the fact that Africa does not manufacture much. I think we've only started manufacturing masks and a few other items for personal protection. Now, this is one very big lesson that we are taking into our stride, and we are planning so that Africa can be able to start manufacturing its own health products. That way, any other outbreak coming in the future, our supply chain will not be disrupted like happened with COVID-19. So we are picking up lessons during this COVID-19 pandemic, which we'll put into good use, hopefully, in the near future.
Talbot, you know, one of the things that became very apparent about COVID-19 is that it has seemed to be an equalizer. Dr. Omar talked about equalizer, but in a different sense in Africa, in that in the past, or typically, when an African politician, an African president or minister gets sick, they get on jets and fly off to London or to the United States to get treatment. But here was a disease where even the West doesn't have a cure for it. Has this helped perhaps bring those sobering moments to African leaders to develop their health systems, knowing that there can be a time where you have no other place to go? You have to take care of yourself at home.
I think it's a time for sober reflection, actually, because in my own country, Liberia, we have similar experience where government officials got ill and they have to be flown out of the country to other areas to get care and all of that. This is the time for us to invest in the human development pillar of our development plans. Sometimes the emphasis on the continent in developing countries, because of the infrastructure gap, more emphasis is put on building big buildings, roads, and infrastructure and all of that. And we forget about the basic human development areas like healthcare, human resources for health, making sure that the supply chain drugs are available in the facilities for people to have care, re-engineering our healthcare facilities. Simple things like infection prevention and control can be an issue. So the basic need of the people, equipping our tertiary healthcare facilities so that we have specialists to deal with some of those things, are very, very much important. And my colleague Ahmed from the CDC, Africa CDC, was saying the thing, the experience from Africa. You know, a lot of countries now, more than 15, I know he knows the number better. The last time I looked at the number a year ago, were 15 African countries that have the public health institutes or CDCs on the continent. I led the development of the Liberia National Public Health Institute, worked with my colleagues in Nigeria and other part of the continent in South Africa, for us to have the National Public Health Institute established under the leadership of John Ahmed Boss. So that put another dynamics in and control system and infrastructure in place for dealing with infectious diseases. Looking back in the past 10 months, the prediction in the first and second quarters of 2020 was green for COVID-19 on the African continent. But today, as compared to the global north, like Europe and America, Africa is fighting an impressive fight in terms of the mobility and mortality that we're looking at right now, a great fight in containing the pandemic. However, in the sub-Saharan African area, as we just said, is disproportionately affected by communicable diseases, HIV and AIDS, malaria, tuberculosis. Non-communicable diseases are on the rise. Health systems are severely challenged, and yet they are all, you know, supply chain and all of those things that I mentioned earlier. So we need to put the system in place to improve our healthcare systems.
You're watching Straight Talk Africa. We'll take a short break and we'll be right back.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Linoch Mudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back. We are looking at the impact of the second wave of the coronavirus pandemic in Africa. My guests are Dr. Ahmed Awel Ouma, Deputy Director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and Tolbert Nyenswa, Senior Research Associate at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Ouma, you talked about Africa having health systems instead of, you know, it's not just hospitals, which is a good thing because it means that virtually everybody has access to some health care. Question is, though, how much confidence can people have in public health systems when the elite, the political leaders don't want to go to those kind of hospitals, those health institutions that they have in their own countries, or when they do have an option, they go to a private, expensive health facility, but not a publicly funded health hospital. So how does that complicate things when it comes to, first, the confidence in the public, the health system that Africa has, but also even in the funding? Is there any desire to develop them if those who are at the top don't think they need them themselves?
I think that that is one very key conversation that has had to be unpacked during this COVID-19 pandemic season. Where most of those who are affected are actually cared for in public facilities. And it has exposed public facilities that are not well equipped, and it has forced many governments, probably most governments, to be able to start improving certain levels of infrastructure in those public facilities. In fact, tragically, some relatively senior people in different countries on this continent have lost their lives because wherever they were, simple things like oxygen was not there. Basic things like an ICU bed could not be made available in an emergency way. So that particular thing, item has been unpacked in discussions. And the need for strengthening public healthcare systems has become even more urgent now. And we usually say that we should not waste an outbreak. We should not waste an emergency. Now, this is the opportunity for us to be able to strengthen our public health systems. It is an opportunity for us to be able to ensure that we have facilities that are spread across a country and can be able to handle, including critical care patients, in a way that is professionally acceptable. But if that does not happen, then for sure countries in Africa are going to continue to suffer this skewed nature of health access, which is not ideal at all. For us, from the Africa CDC side, we encourage universal health care and universal health coverage, both together, so that citizens, wherever they are in a country, can be able to be attended to based on the need they have, not how much money that they can be able to access. But I really see that our leaders have appreciated the need for building good quality infrastructure for healthcare within a country, because times come when you can't be able to be flown out, and whatever needs to be done has to be done within the country. And this pandemic has brought that message home very, 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 very clearly.
Indeed, I can't wait to see the time when the African leaders would see their fellow citizens as equals, so that they can develop the health systems that treat everybody. So we don't have to keep seeing them go abroad and spend millions of dollars getting treatment in Western capitals. No Western leader comes to a continent to seek medical treatment. And so it's a shame, really. So, Talbot, you know, we are now talking about this new strain, and mostly now in South Africa. What should we know about it, the new coronavirus strain that is spread even to the U.S. right now?
So, number one, this is what we need to know. Number one, viruses like the coronaviruses and even parasites like malaria that our people used to mutate all the time. So this is not new about mutation of new strains and variants with the coronavirus. They do mutate. And number two is to avoid panic. Normally when people are panicking, they forget to take the measures that are necessary. We noticed there are a lot of panicking among people about new strain of the virus. The one that we're dealing with in South Africa, the B1351, though contagious, but it's not a virulent. It wouldn't kill like Ebola will kill people, though there will be more cases that will bring the healthcare facility to its brain. And so we need to act faster, because when people get sick and there's more hospitalization, then more deaths will occur. So we'll have more cases, but those systems should be set up to deal with that. Another thing is that my colleagues, we were discussing at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health about whether or not, because of the new strain of the virus, we need to worry about the new vaccines that have been produced. For example, the Pfizer vaccine, the Moderna vaccines, whether the new strain will have resistance to the vaccines. But that evidence is not shown yet. We know no evidence that the vaccine will not work or protect people against the new variant that we're dealing with. So to reinforce this, number one, viruses do mutate. Number two, we should get the health facilities more stronger because we have more cases. And number three, people should not panic about that.
I'd like to add on to that, please, on the new strains and also the South Africa situation.
Yes, indeed. In fact, as we speak now, we are seeing the South African strain also has been documented in Zambia. Nigeria has documented another slightly different variant as well. And it is an expectation that the viruses, as Talbot is saying, will be changing their nature to try and become, to survive better within the human population. But key here is the same public health measures will be able to be effective for whichever variant of virus we will have, irrespective of whether it is the South African one, the UK one, and as many more countries continue to do full genomic sequencing, I'm quite confident that we will be seeing a few other variants popping up. But all those variants can be effectively controlled by using the same public health measures that we had from the beginning. So if we continue to be disciplined in the way that we approach our social interactions, we can be able to limit whichever variant of virus that comes. And finally on this is to say that as Africa CDC, we are now setting up centers around the continent. We have about 8 around the continent that are doing pathogen genomics to ensure that we are doing genetic studies and doing genetic surveillance. That way we get to know when any mutations are coming through or not. And this we are doing very actively so that it becomes one of the tools that will be available to us, whichever pathogen it will be, whether it is this virus or another one or any bacteria or any other pathogens that may be giving us a headache out there in as far as outbreaks are concerned. It's a very, very key tool in understanding how these pathogens are changing and what we can be able to do to ensure that members of the public are better protected.
Now, Talbot, the early months of last year when this thing broke out, we remember the Madagascar juice, which was touted as possibly, you know, having some therapeutic, you know, value and could prevent people from getting sick or could cure people. You know, some laughed it off, some used it, and some have said, why shouldn't Africa be engaging very vigorously in research when it comes to such issues as this pandemic or any other? Why should Africa wait for Western big companies or for Western countries to come up with vaccines and then they'll be on the line to try and get some? And now we know that millions have been scooped out by Western countries, and that's another question that we'll discuss. So, but focus on the area of research and you know, discovery, given that, you know, Africans also have been known to come up with great ideas, right?
Oh, sure. And the thing is, homeopathic, Ayurvedic medicines, traditional medicines, they are encouraged. They are well encouraged. I know the World Health Organization have been pushing that, the West African Health Organization, Africa CDC, and all of the organizations on the continent, the WHO African region, have been pushing the issue of traditional medicine and using herbs and all of that. But the caveat is that it has to go through processes that are documented, that everybody can see, the scientific community can look at, because the standards are the same. There is no one standard for Africa, Europe, and America. We have to go through the rigorous process of research and putting the findings out there in a peer-reviewed journal for everybody to look at. And so the issue of R&D has always been underfunded in our R&D, research and development and therapeutics and all of that, have always been the least on our continent when it comes to putting resources there. So what I would think, we encourage our African governments to put more efforts into resources. What I find against is coming up with things that are not scientifically proven by data and then running with it for your citizens to have it at helps or treatment. That is completely unconventional.
But Dr. Umar, you know, of course, as Robert mentions, there's a process, and sometimes this is what complicates matters. But also some have opined that perhaps there is not much confidence in Africans to come up with a solution. And if you're as old as I am, Dr. Umar, you might remember a Dr. Obel in Kenya who did research at the Kenya Medical Research Institute and came up with what he believed to be a cure for HIV and AIDS. But it was dismissed, and for so many reasons, it was never taken up as something that can be perhaps one of the solutions in the toolkit to fight HIV. And way before then, there had been another kind of, you know, some other thing that was developed, especially in Kenya, in KEMRI. So here's a question from the CDC standpoint, you know, does Africa have the capacity to do any kind of research that can stand, you know, the standards and can stand, you know, to be counted just like any other findings that we see from other countries, whether it's China or Europe or the United States?
The brain power is present. the experienced professional scientists are present. What is lacking is resources to ensure that the R&D, the research and development part, is actually supported fully from the beginning to the end. And this is what we have encouraged our member states to put aside resources to ensure that our scientists are properly supported to be able to develop things locally. And it is possible. There are examples on the continent that we can be able to cite. And in fact, for those illnesses that are relatively endemic here on the continent, the easiest solutions are going to also come from here on the continent, if we provide our scientists and experts with the resources they need to be able to develop the therapies that will be required. And, you know, the big gap is documentation. Africans have for quite a while not been very vigorous in documenting what works so that it can be able to be repeated from one situation to another, from one country to another. That documentation is what we are trying to put infrastructure in place to ensure that it is present. And this is out of what you referred to from Madagascar, but other countries have some products as well. Kenya, Tanzania, Gabon have all come up with some, Mauritania, with some products that need to be properly tested so that we are sure that they are safe and we are sure that they are efficacious. And the standards, as Tolbert is saying, are clear. We don't need to go reinventing the wheel. We just need to make sure that the resources are present so that we get good numbers in as far as, you know, trials are concerned, and we show whether a product is working or not. But the big, big gap is enough resources for research and development in Africa, and that needs to be fixed so that we can be able to start tackling the diseases that we see the most locally and get into that space of developing proper health therapies, proper health products that are going to be able to stand on the same shelf as those that are coming from other parts of the world. We have the brain power. What we need is for governments to start investing aggressively into providing the proper infrastructure and then providing resources for these trials to be conducted from the beginning all the way to the end.
To follow Buttress now, Vincent, Liberia was one of the first countries to prove that to develop a vaccines or do a randomized clinical trial, which is the gold standard for any scientific testing, was done in Liberia in the midst of an emergency. The Ebola outbreak was going on when we were looking for Ebola vaccines, and we did it right there in Liberia with the technology, with the people, in partnership, though, with the National Institute of Health. We developed Ebola vaccines. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and you can find how in an emergency setting that a groundbreaking solution can be found for a disease. Today, the Western countries are developing COVID-19 vaccines. It was done right in West Africa, in Liberia, where we did it with Ebola. So the experience, I agree around that, the technology, the people are there, resources, what lacking.
And the experts are there, the researchers are there. I have personally visited the Ifakara Institute of Research in Tanzania. They are doing an amazing job. At the time I went there trying to find some vaccine against malaria, especially among children. And also I've seen what the work in Kenya Medical Research Institute is doing. So their people are there. Some infrastructure is there. I think they need more support from their governments and, if possible, some other international organizations. Well, let's turn to vaccinations. They are underway in the Western nations vigorously at this time. Question is, what's our schedule looking like, Dr. Umar, in Africa for vaccination?
We are estimating that Africa will start vaccinations for COVID-19 towards the end of the first quarter. So sometime in March and early April is when we may be able to start that. And I say this because the path of getting vaccines onto the continent is not as straightforward as it is for countries in the West. We as Africa CDC right now are in a deep discussion with all the vaccine manufacturers so that we can be able to start getting the first doses onto the continent within the first quarter of 2021. Apart from that, we are also working with individual governments in Africa for the infrastructure required for vaccination to be ready. Because if you can have the vaccine, but if you don't take it to vaccination, it is of no use. We want to make sure that when the first doses are coming in, the systems are ready. And then the vaccines are taken all the way down to the health facility where vaccination can then be able to happen. Many times we focus so much on the vaccine, but delivering that vaccine requires a whole system. Indeed, you will need needles, you will need syringes, you will need swabs, you will need a trained personnel. How do you dispose of the needles after you have done what you've done? How do you monitor the individuals who are getting the vaccine so that in case there is any adverse reactions, the healthcare system is ready to be able to take care of that? How do you ensure that the person who got vaccine A will come back after 1 month or 6 weeks to get a second dose of the same vaccine and not another one? So that there's a lot of infrastructural issues, logistical issues that need to be put in place before we start vaccination on the continent. But in as far as purchase is concerned, very advanced discussions through the COVAX facility and directly with other manufacturers from different parts of the world who are manufacturing COVID-19 vaccines so that we can be able to get these vaccines onto the continent within the first quarter of 2021.
And I'm going to ask this to both of you. First, I want to stay with you, Dr. Umar. Are we, to put it bluntly, at the back of the queue, waiting for these vaccines? I mean, you talk about April, somewhere there. Anything can happen between now and then in terms of the infections.
I wouldn't say we are at the back of the queue because, remember, for herd immunity to be breached, really we need to do at least 60% of the population. And we are quite confident that we will be within the timeline that is expected. Three months is good. 3 months is good. We are not at the back of the queue. There are a few countries that are already ahead because they did purchase these vaccines before the vaccines could even be cleared as successful. So they invested ahead of time. While in our case, our countries are waiting for the successful vaccines to be known, and then we are buying what has already been cleared for use in human beings. So the style is the one that is different, but we are not at the back of the queue. Until every part of the world is vaccinated, then the whole world is still at risk. If you vaccinate only one portion, the mutations we are talking about, the variations we are talking about earlier, will appear. And when they do, and they are significant, then you will find trouble even for those who had been vaccinated initially if it is the change is big enough. So we must be able to contain the virus in a very rapid way across the globe and within Africa, starting within the first quarter, I think is not too bad. And we are pushing to ensure that when we start, it is going to be consistent for the next 18 months so that we can be able to reach the 60% that we have calculated to be what we need on the continent to reach a comfortable level of immunity.
Tobias, what's your take?
Yeah, on the Africa having access to vaccines and how rapidly, the number one good news, Vincent, is that the people of Africa the upbeat and optimism of acceptance to vaccines is encouraging, because I was looking at a perception survey report on COVID-19 vaccine conducted by AMEX Institution, Africa CDC, and the London Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. 80% of Africans surveyed said they were willing to take the vaccines. If you look at the global north, that number is very, very low. Vaccine perception of hesitancy and refusal is an issue. So on the continent, the people, I feel they are ready of those surveys. That's number one. And number two, individual African countries on the continent who finance vaccines for their people to get inoculated to have the vaccines in their arm, because vaccines, as often said, don't save life. What save life is vaccination. And it goes with issue of supply chain, issue of logistics, issue of cold chain, storage, training, large-scale communication, community engagement are very, very important in delivering the vaccine. So since Africa is still waiting for the doses to arrive, some of these things are things that government should start doing, putting in place the communication system, sensitizing the people, getting the kind of storage and supply chain. On a global level, I think there is good news, because the World Bank, the other time in October, put up about $20 billion to finance vaccine through the COVAX initiative. COVAX is initiative of WHO, CEPI, and Gavi, and the rest of them. And so the good news, the resources are available to provide ensuring global equity access to COVID-19 vaccines. And I think if the African continent can put us through the Africa CDC and WHO and the African governments to see how to start putting in some orders and don't wait so that we don't be at the bottom of the line, that would be an incredible piece of job that the system needs to do. Like yesterday, I was looking at some of the report. WHO is now put out an announcement to recruit experts for allocating vaccines to developing and low middle income countries. And over 92 countries are in the pipeline to receive vaccines from the COVAX initiative when the allocation is in place, equitable distribution. And again, I will reemphasize what my colleague Amber said. One country with COVID left out of the vaccine supplies immunization, the entire world is not safe. So the rich countries need to look at the poor country to get the vaccine. Equity, wealth should not be a barrier, or wealth, not having wealth should not be a barrier of inoculating people.
We hope for the best. Here's the question I'd like you to answer briefly. What would be best possible scenario in Africa 2021? And what's the worst case scenario? And we want to hope for the very best case scenario here.
Let me start by saying that as Africa CDC, we are planning for the worst. While quite clear that looking at what we've done in 2020, we'll probably end up with very close to the best, if not the best. So the worst case scenario will be if this second wave were to be significantly higher in terms of the peak than the first wave. That would be really, really bad.
We will hang on to the best case scenario. Thank you very much. That's our time. I want to thank you very much. And on that note, our distinguished guests are Dr. Ahmed Ogwell Coleman and Talbot Nyesua. I want to thank our audience for joining our conversation on Straight Talk Africa. Thank you and have a good evening.